For WagingNonviolence.org, I'm Nathan Schneider. I'm here with Will Bates of 350.org, talking about what he, together with his colleagues and veteran writer and activist Bill McKibben, are doing to create a worldwide movement for a treaty strong enough to stave off the threat of climate change.
Sometimes the most useful way to explain our thinking behind all of this is to tell a bit of like our story, which is like how it all got started. A lot of our thinking and philosophy has kind of just grown organically from that, which is that all of us here went to Middlebury College together, and it was, all of us had, I personally and each of us, I think, on some level shared this like long-term sort of general interest and care and concern about the issue of climate change, which most of us had seen as like the dominant crisis facing the planet, but had no real sense of what to do about it. And then we were just really fortunate that we all felt pretty similarly at a time when a professor of ours taught a course called Climate Change and Social Movements, which helped us, triggered us thinking about like social movement theory in like an actual academic sense, as well as just diving into learning about the history of the civil rights movement and other social movements, and just being really inspired by all that and putting our own concern about the issue of climate change into the context of the possibility of creating a social movement on that issue. Mm-hmm. And social movement / political movement. And that, in some ways, it was the key breakthrough to recognize that because the issue of climate change is so big, that the endless call, particularly in the U.S., that we've heard from a lot of environmental groups and other groups, that like we each need to change our own lifestyles, like one light bulb at a time, one family at a time, one community at a time, just wasn't enough. And to transition away from that towards creating a mass political shift in order to transform our entire economy enough, fast enough to really solve this crisis, that needed to become the basis for a movement, as opposed to just everybody change their light bulbs and ride a bike. And
so why did you center the campaign around 350?
Oh, okay, well, so yeah, so just jumped from then to the present. So the number 350 itself, is the scientific, there's a paper that came out at the beginning of 2008 led by NASA scientist James Hansen. 350 parts per million is what they identified as the safe upper limit of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so a number was useful in a couple different senses. For a lot of people who didn't know a lot about climate change, it was just one number that, once understood, the fact that we're above that, we're at 390 parts per million. When we started the campaign, we were at 387 parts per million. Once people recognize that we're above that, that one number becomes a significant piece of information that's really powerful. So for people new to climate change, it's one of the simplest ways to jump straight to the core of the issue, that it's a massive crisis and that we're already too high. It's also really useful to campaign around a number because it's Arabic numerals are the most universally recognizable thing worldwide and don't require translation. So having just a number to spread can work across borders. And also, it's really intriguing to people. Like, why are we so obsessed about a number? People are always curious to know why a number. And then lastly, the number is really significant politically. For a long time, the United Nations climate negotiations have loosely based themselves off of trying to reach a 450 parts per million target. And now that we know that that's insufficient and that's too high, there's a political substance to saying, let's shift to 350. So those factors combined made it ripe for organizing. What we decided to do, and we had had some experience with this both in college and in Vermont and in the U.S., is creating a campaign that had that common, unifying global message but opening it up to local groups to pour in their own energy, their own creativity, doing it in the context more of building a movement than in building an organization. Our ideal situations are when groups, like there's an amazing group in New Zealand that just adopted it completely. They run the campaign themselves. Like, they've changed the logo and the graphics. Like, they've made it their own, and we have very little control over it. But because it's part of, it has the 350 message in it, it's connected to this global movement, and that's beautiful to us. And like, so.
And tell us what the global movement is trying to accomplish.
So our big focus this year is to organize a global day of action on October 24th. Again, it's the essential idea is that local communities organize creative actions at iconic places. So whether it be bike rides or climbing mountains or underwater, at the Taj Mahal, the Empire State Building, whatever it might be, doing things in public, actually getting communities out into the spotlight, into the media, into communities, really being public about this number and this call to action. And all of the purpose of it is, this is 6 weeks in advance of this year's United Nations climate negotiations, which will take place in Copenhagen this December. And that is going to be one of the most crucial meetings in human history, where there's the potential for a treaty or agreement or whatever they end up calling it, that will set a cap on carbon, or at least some kind of policy to determine how the world internationally is going to cooperate to deal with climate change. And ideally, we'd like to see that agreement lead us towards getting back below 350 parts per million, which will be a challenge, and it will require dramatic, bold actions there. But what we're trying to do is amass enough citizen, public, global public pressure to create the political space to make that possible.
And so why did you choose to do this more performance-oriented approach in visible spaces rather than actions like getting in the way of carbon emitters or these sorts of disobedience crusades?
Well, we do a mix of all of it. In fact, our campaign, and like earlier this year, we were involved with a civil disobedience at the Washington, D.C. coal-fired power plant, where a couple thousand people blockaded the coal-fired power plant. So we are involved with that, and some of that might take place on October 24th as well. But our emphasis is on just sort of more public creative actions, both political and educational. And our reason for that, in some ways, goes back to our just sort of our group's past experience, where, again, when we started in college, we were able to build a really strong campus movement through doing really fun activities. Like, when we realized that how many possible campaigning and actions there were to do, we just started doing them. And we discovered that, by playing broom ball, which is a game we play in Vermont on ice with no skates and brooms instead of hockey sticks and balls instead of pucks, we did that at the State House calling to Save Winter. And it was, like, goofy and fun. It got media attention, and it got lots of people excited, such that the next time around when we did a 40-mile bike ride, even more people showed up. And so we just discovered that doing these sometimes quirky but fun, engaging, interesting stories, that had it was more captivating and ultimately had more political power to it, because it actually drew the attention necessary to get a message across.
And how does that getting the message across translate into the political pressure that you'll need in order to accomplish something in the UN?
Well, on some level, it's media attention is political power. And we learned that in two experiences, one in Vermont, where by gathering over 1,000 people after a 5-day walk across the state, we were able to get, because we were starting to build a media buzz around the fact that we were walking for 5 days, and that was kind of crazy, We got every single candidate for federal office to show up at our final rally and sign a pledge. And then we did a Step It Up, this campaign called Step It Up in 2007, where we got enough media coverage of the 1,400 actions taking place all across the U.S. that a few days after the National Day of Action that we organized then, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had adopted the goal that we had set through that campaign. And the reality is we can't actually terribly concretely attribute it to what we did. We have no known link that they actually said it. They picked up a paper, saw the article, or someone told them about it, and therefore they changed their policy. But it's a pretty clear link that, you know, a few days after a mass mobilization, they adopted the policy. So we've basically just seen it proven that by generating a lot of public interest, politicians follow. And that's, to some degree, what we be hoping. That's the way in which we hope to accomplish that for Copenhagen.
And you're working all around the world. You're working in Turkey and in the Middle East, and especially in Asia and India. Mm-hmm. Do you think that works in the United States, maybe to some extent? Mm-hmm. Is it different in these other countries?
Well, to some degree, we're going to learn that. The full answer to that question in the months to come, we'll learn that. But I think, I don't know, our sense is that, and it seems, since people seem to be jumping on the campaign, in general we're getting great response to the campaign from all around the world, there's the sense that it can have the same effect.
So are there, you talked about encouraging other people to do kind of self-directed creative actions on their own. Are there limits that you impose or suggest? You know, how far they can go. The difference between doing a dance in front of the Taj Mahal and painting the Taj Mahal green or something.
Onto the Taj Mahal. So we don't generally get too nitty-gritty in communicating with organizers' ideas, although if we were to ever find out someone planned to paint the Taj Mahal, we would definitely step in to say, we don't think that's a great idea, here's why. I think there's only a few, in our past experience, there's only been a couple of cases where we've actually had to tell organizers, we actually think that's a bad idea. Steer clear of that. I don't remember. I remember we've done that before. I don't remember what those cases were. But for the most part, we find that people, I mean, on some levels, we actually tend to want to encourage people to be a little bit more hard-hitting than they are. Like, we love some of the really fun ones, and so we love that they're there. But sometimes we actually really want to encourage people to be taking it directly to politicians and making a more direct political engagement with it. And we love, like, you know, this is some, like, we as a group have a personal, like, we've chosen this model of creative actions partially because it's fun and it's, we think it's effective. Or that's why we've chosen it, but like, we also have this desire to really speak the truth about dirty energy. And like, a lot, before we did the Step It Up campaign, our idea as a group of friends was to go to Montana and fight coal plants. And so like, we were going to be really like on the front lines doing that kind of stuff. And so we kind of have that, we harbor that desire within us, so sometimes we try to instigate it amongst the people we work with. But it's usually lending more in that direction where there's really creative stuff happening. And the best part about all this is when people come up with ideas we would never think of, and we just get really excited when people are doing things that we don't come up with, and so we just encourage that as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things come to mind?
So a couple of recent ones, like there's a whole bunch of music, 350 music that people have written, some of which is really beautiful, and like, we don't even know that they're going to do it. Suddenly we get an email one day and there's a great new 350 song, and there's now enough so we can like assemble an album of 350 songs. And recently we got word that, like, I was at the Indian Youth Climate Summit, and people were really enthusiastic and excited there. And then a week later, we got an email from a group from the city of Hyderabad that had been so excited that during the train ride back to Hyderabad, they had gone the length of the train talking to every single person on the train about 350 and assembled them for a photo afterwards when the train, like, the people were getting off the train in Hyderabad. And so people just do stuff, and it's really exciting and powerful to know that they're, like, almost by inviting their participation, inviting and encouraging their creativity, it unleashes more than we'd ever expect.
Mm-hmm. It's really neat. So the day of action is, again?
October 24th, Saturday.
Okay.
6 weeks before the big Copenhagen conference. And there's, in the United States, I think approaching 800 to 1,000, I don't know the exact number, actions registered in all 50 states, and another 1,000 beyond that worldwide, and over more than half the countries of the world.
And so people can find out more on 350.org?
That's right. And there's ways to search for actions. There's some fun animations that people can share with their friends. It's on Facebook and all the rest.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much, Will.
Good. Yeah, thank you.
For WagingNonviolence.org, I'm Nathan Schneider.